Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Last week, we talked with Colin Asher, author of the biography Never a Lovely So Real, The Life and Work of Nelson Algren. This week, AWM President Carrie Cranston chats with Manisha Sinha about the legacy of Frederick Douglass and other abolitionists from her book, The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. This conversation was recorded live May 28th, 2020. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
I want to thank everybody for coming online tonight with us. I'm here in the museum. Tonight, we have a special guest, Dr. Manisha Sinha, who actually visited the museum back in 2018 when we had our Frederick Douglass exhibit up. And we thought it would be great to have her back here today because we launched a new microsite today. Similar to our My America microsite that we launched about a month ago, we've now launched www.fd-agitator.org for Frederick Douglass Agitator. And it has the content of the exhibit that we had here behind me in our writer's room between June of 2018, and June of 2019. So our guest tonight, Dr. Manisha Sinha, is the James L. and Shirley A. Draper Chair in American History at the University of Connecticut, a leading authority on the history of slavery and abolition and the Civil War and Reconstruction. She was born in India, received her PhD from Columbia University, where her dissertation was nominated for the Bancroft Prize. She's the author of The Counter-Revolution of Slavery, Politics and Ideology in Antebellum South Carolina, which was named one of the 10 best books on slavery by Politico in 2015 and was recently featured in the New York Times 1619 Project. Her multiple award-winning second monograph, The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, was long-listed for the National Book Award for Nonfiction, was named the Book of the Week by the Times Higher Education to coincide with its UK publication, and was one of the three great history books of 2016, according to Bloomberg News, as well as winning the 2017 Frederick Douglass Book Prize. So please help me in welcoming Dr. Manisha Sinha. And Dr. Sinha, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're excited that you're here. I wanted to thank you. You were back here in 2018, as I mentioned, for when we had our Frederick Douglass exhibit. We just launched that online. So we're excited about that. And we're excited that you could join us tonight. I'm going to jump into some questions about your book, which I enjoyed thoroughly. But it's a huge book. It's looking at a gigantic topic, 100 years of history, really, at least more, related to abolition, as you start as early as 1720, with kind of the precursors to what we think of as the abolition movement. And as a writer's museum, I'm compelled to ask you about process that went into trying to tackle a project as large as this. You know, first off, I'm kind of interested in what compelled you to want to tell this particular story of abolition and the focus that you brought to it.
Well, you know, when I started writing this book, I was unsatisfied with the way in which abolitionists had been portrayed both in popular culture, but also in academic histories of the abolition movement. And I decided I would write a book on African-American abolitionists in particular. And I realized that there had been many books written on Black abolitionists, on women in the movement, but that no one had really placed them in the movement as a whole to uncover their significance. I also realized that one could not just look at the conventional period when it comes to studying abolition, which is the antebellum period, just 30 years or so before the Civil War. So that's how it became a bigger project. I went right back to the revolutionary era to look at some early abolitionists, because most of the abolitionists in the 19th century talked about them as having inspired them. So the book just kept growing, as you can imagine. It became this sort of new comprehensive history, a 100-year history of abolition, looking at both the first wave in the 18th century and then at the second wave of abolitionists just before the Civil War.
Yeah, and I mean, I was kind of fascinated the way you start off with, you know, slaves uprising on a ship and literally fighting back, you know, is really that first part in this notion that there were you know, it's the integration of everybody involved in the movement, I think, that's so fascinating. As you said, we tend to hear the stories of freed slaves and their struggles, and we tend to talk about the abolitionists like the Garrisons and others as another group, sort of like the white moderate liberals who are over here preaching about something versus those who are living it, but not the integration. And I thought that was really interesting. It must have taken you quite a while to do all this research. I'm curious, how long of a project was this for you?
It was a very long project. It took me 10 years. It took me 10 years to research and write this book. In the last few years, I literally spent just sort of refining it and shortening it. And even though it's sort of a big book, mm-hmm. there's nearly 150 pages of footnotes. So right. it looks bigger than, you know, if you want, you can avoid the footnotes and just read the text. But, you know, I want to go back to the point that you made early on about how I began with a shipboard rebellion in that slave trade. And one of the reasons I did that was not just to center African Americans in the story of abolition, but to center slave resistance. In the story of abolition. And we can see this with, you know, not just slave rebellions, but also with the ways in which fugitive slaves like Douglass ultimately join the movement and come to lead it and define some of its tactics and ideas. And I was unsatisfied with the ways in which people had sort of compartmentalized the story. So if you read a white abolitionist talking about the Haitian Revolution or about a particular slave rebellion in the Caribbean or Nat Turner's rebellion, you would not get a sense that somehow these moments were very much part of the movement. At least contemporaries saw it that way. So even much of the literature that had been written on slave rebellions and resistance was separate from the story of abolition. And I felt it was really important not just to integrate African Americans back into the movement, but to integrate stories of Black resistance back into the history of abolition.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, and I'm forgetting the name, the captain of a ship, of his own ship, an African American former slave who starts a movement for going back to colonizing in Africa or setting up an emigration point.
Yes, that was Paul Cuffey. He was a Black Quaker sea captain from Massachusetts. And, you know, he was very interested in the idea of starting a kind of a back to Africa immigration movement. And his whole purpose was to found a modern Black nation where African Americans could have political equality and citizenship, which he did not see happening in the new slaveholding republic. And this was a little different than the colonization movement that arose later on and that was mainly led by prominent white politicians and clergymen who literally just wanted to get rid of the Black population in the United States, especially the free Black population, but retain the enslaved population. Paul Cuffey's plan was to actually found a Black nation and also as a way to actually end slavery rather than perpetuate it in the United States.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that you mentioned that he had his entire crew was African-American. You know, like he had this entire ship crew that he brought over with him, that it was really a movement of African-Americans trying to find their own nation. And it was really interesting and not something that I was familiar with. One of the things you mentioned early on in the book and that comes up obviously throughout as you talk about different pamphlets and different books and different narratives is that you write that abolitionists were wordsmiths, that what they lacked in power, they kind of made up for in their written materials and the preponderance of their written materials. Can you talk a little bit about how important the written word was to abolition?
Absolutely. Abolitionist print culture is so important because that was the one weapon they had in order to influence public opinion and convert people on the subject of slavery. Because as far as the sort of national political arena was concerned, there was a sort of an understanding that as long as you had this union with Southern slaveholders, that one would not bring up the issue of slavery, that somehow it was threatening to this union and to the compromises, the constitutional compromises made over the issue of slavery. So abolitionist print culture became a way in which to sort of disseminate their ideas. And the print culture was fairly democratic in the sense that you could disseminate this literature through the United States Postal Service fairly cheaply. This is why the U.S. Postal Service is so important, such an important institution for our democracy. And you could have women and African Americans participate in it, in this print culture on an equal basis, even though they were denied the formal rights of citizenship in the formal public arena. And so it was extremely important. And what was important, what was interesting for me to see was the emergence of a sort of a modern radical social movement with, you know, modern means of communication, pamphlets, newspapers. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they have this sort of old-fashioned moralizing sort of idea too, with, you know, basic Christian precepts of do unto others, etc. But you can see the emergence of a quintessential modern radical American movement. And the fact that it was interracial and the fact that women played such an important role in it, you know, was really interesting to me. But yes, print culture was extremely important. They left a very interesting archive, the abolitionists. There's music, there's theater, there's material culture. And as a historian, I felt that I was already trespassing on, you know, the turf usually of literary scholars by really trying to understand a lot of the literature that they produced. And I didn't perhaps do justice to these other sources. It's a complicated archive, but I know people have worked on it and have continued to, will continue to work on it. But yes, I was looking at these sources, and a lot of historians would tell me, well, you know, this is just literature. How is this a historical source? Yeah. And I had to convince them that this was important in terms of understanding the abolition movement.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to the mission of our institution, you know, part of the reason we had that exhibit on Douglass was because of the notion that it's the prime example of the power of literacy, of writing, and of written literacy. You know, it's not just the notion that he could learn to read, but the notion that then he could write and communicate, that allowed him to move a nation. So, you know, I totally agree with you on the importance of it from a historical perspective. It isn't just literature. On a side note, if you had, you know, three or four of the writers that came out of it, you know, maybe besides Douglass, who do you think in their era had the most impact through their written works, whether they were books or pamphlets or newspapers? I mean, who were some of the other written sources?
I would definitely say Garrison, William Lloyd Garrison, and his Liberator. You know, Garrison was a master at sort of making that polemical argument against slavery. And it was so important for him to sort of take those, what was seen at that time, extreme and radical positions, but to us, appears as the humane position and the logical position and the most moral position to take at the time. But just reading The Liberator from page to page, from 1831 right down to 1865 till he wound up with the newspaper, was eye-opening for me, because all I had read about Garrison were caricatures, and except for one really very good biography, not by a historian, but by an independent writer, Henry Mayer, All on Fire, I found most of the views of Garrison's to be caricatures, especially in history books. Very influenced, I think, by a whole group of revisionist Southern historians, the Civil War period. And so I really enjoyed reading his essays, and I would recommend them to anyone. And then I really enjoyed reading the women abolitionists. Their view of abolition as part of a broader human rights project that would also include women's rights. was eye-opening for me. So you said four, but I'll name four women because they're so many, right? Rumke sisters, certainly, Sarah and Angelina, their work, Lydia Maria Child, some of her essays and novels, and then Maria Stuart and Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, not very well known, but Black women abolitionists who wrote and spoke for abolition, and Harper was an accomplished poet too. Different genres. You know, there's nonfiction, there's the polemical essay, there were novels, there were poetry. I really did think that those were the ones that really spoke to me. And then I loved reading Charles Sumner's speeches and all his letters, because he was just so erudite. And I just love tracing all his illusions. Americans didn't get him. They think, oh God, this man is so pretentious. Why is he so learned? But if you are a historian or a writer, you could really appreciate his speeches and, even his loyalty briefs for desegregation of the Boston school system, which was actually studied by the NAACP lawyers at Thurgood Marshall in Brown v. Board of Education. So these words were very effective too for a long time after he was gone. So those were my favorites. And then of course, Douglas, there were other militant Black abolitionists who didn't write that much, but who wrote that one extremely influential pamphlet. So David Walker's Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World. You could literally hear him because of the ways in which he capitalizes and punctuates the text. When you're reading it, you feel as if you're hearing him. You're hearing his anger, his frustration at being a Black man in a slaveholding republic. Similarly with Henry Highland Garnett's Address to the Slaves. These are iconic texts. But and Garnett wrote and spoke more than that too. But unlike Douglas or Garrison, and Sumner, who consistently wrote over a long period of time, that they have an oeuvre that you can unpack. I found them really. So you can see that I find it very difficult to contain myself when it comes to just like pinpoint four or five. But these were my favorites, I would say, yeah.
Okay, well, that's great. You kind of touched on this a little bit, but I'm curious about this kind of myth, and you mentioned it as kind of the Southern revisionist, but the this preconceived notion we might have of what the abolitionist movement was, or what we might think of it. What do you see as kind of the preconceived notion of the general public, modern general public today, of what abolitionists were versus what they really were?
So in popular culture, I would say abolitionists are often seen as northern white middle-class men and women who just took up the cause of the slave. Sometimes they're portrayed as saintly. Sometimes they're portrayed as hypocritical, because what did they really know about slavery sitting up in the North, right? And again, a very ahistorical view of the movement as a whole, because, you know, many of them, like Garrison, you know, he was an indentured servant, virtually. He was a very poor apprentice and poor and an orphan apprentice to hard labor as a child. Many of these white abolitionists were hardly, what we would call bourgeois by any standard, even the women, and they devoted their lives to the movement. So most of them were constantly in need for funds. They were very much in close contact with both free African Americans and with fugitive slaves who came up north and joined the movement. And many of their ideas, you know, many of the things that Garrison said and did sounded so radical. But then if you look at some of these militant Black abolitionists in the 1820s who preceded him, you can see where he got many of his ideas from. And he openly says that. So in the first issues of The Liberator, he has either he or somebody, and I have a feeling it could have been him, reviews David Walker's pamphlet in not just one review, but four or five. And you can see him being very influenced by militant Black abolitionism. So the interracialism of the movement gets completely lost. Right. And many times, you know, we don't even investigate what white abolitionists are saying at that time about their relationships with African Americans. So I found that I had to really dive deep into the archives and do a lot of primary research. I found I could not rely sometimes on books that repeated the same misconceptions again and again, and that I really had to unpack those stories on my own.
Yeah.
So I would say that is the misconception. We forget that this was a radical interracial movement made up of ordinary men and women, black and white, and not some sort of northern white middle class saints removed from, or armchair moralists removed from, the horrors of slavery, which is the way, in fact, that most of their critics and slaveholders portrayed them as.
Yeah, yeah. And in truth, some of them are literally putting their lives in danger because of the positions that they're taking and because of some of the work that they did. So, yeah, from it was really interesting to kind of see that, you know, because I think I walked into it with the same preconceived notion of this idea of the white liberal sitting up in the North, just proselytizing about this is a bad thing and you all should do something about it, but I don't want to give up my creature comforts. But then, as you said, most of these people did give up their creature comforts if they even had any. And they spent their entire life, you know. I mean, when you mentioned, you know, Garrison's The Liberator, he shuts it down in 65, I think you said, you know, kind of at the end of the war, because he feels like, well, I'm done. But of course, there's still more work to do. But he's been doing it for 40 years or almost at that point. So, you know, the exhaustion of every day of his life.
Absolutely. And his wife is very ill at that point, too. And, you know, there's a sense that somehow Garrison thought that the abolitionist project was achieved with emancipation, that he actually did not support the fight for black citizenship. And that's a misconception, because he continues to write.
Yeah.
He starts running The Liberator because he thinks that's it. And he thinks the American Anti-Slavery Society has fought for abolition, but he really realizes that the center of gravity in terms of effective political change has moved from this radical social movement to the halls of government at this point, which is ironic because he was not a political abolitionist. He's a big supporter of Lincoln. He's a big supporter of the Republican Party. When some abolitionists think that, you know, they should ditch Lincoln for someone more radical, he says, absolutely not. We need to stand united because this is the point where slaveholders are going to try and come back. So he continues to fight for, but not in the ways in which he thought was needed, a radical agitational movement for abolition. Yeah.
You bring this up, and so I was going to kind of jump, you know, the issue of, you know, Garrison and Douglas in the beginning, you know, when Douglas is a young man who's gotten himself freed from slavery and becomes a speaker, and Garrison meets him, and then they become very tightly connected for a long period of time working together. And so Douglas is more or less a Garrisonian at that point. And then when he goes to England, he kind of meets other people, and Douglas becomes a political abolitionist. And what I find interesting about this is that the division between the two really seems to be on a reading of the Constitution. So if you look at a written document again, Garrison is reading the document as, and his disciples, as something that needs to go away, that it is inherently flawed and evil because it was built on the back of slavery. And Douglas is with him there, but then comes back and falls in with the political abolitionists that you mentioned, who are more focused on changing government. Can you talk in more depth than I can about this division and why they separate and that kind of thing?
And again, you know, the Garrison-Douglas split is really interesting and has always been portrayed as merely a racial split. And I think that's just too simple, because there were many black abolitionists who remained Garrisonians, and there were many white abolitionists who were political abolitionists, too simplistic. What is interesting is that after Douglas comes back from his triumphant tour of Britain. And at that point, he's still a Garrisonian. And his tours are really arranged by the Garrisonians, mainly by British Garrisonians. And he's, you know, moving around them, around in England, 18 months, I think he spends lecturing in England. And he's sent there mainly because his narrative is out and people are nervous that, in fact, his former owner will try and, you know, try and recapture him. When he raises money to buy his freedom, a lot of Garrisonians criticize him because they think it's hypocritical for him to acknowledge the right to property in human beings. But Garrison defends him. He calls it ransom. He says it's like paying a kidnapper. You know, Douglas is too valuable to our movement to lose. So the break really comes after Douglas comes back to the United States and he moves to upstate New York. And upstate New York is a hotbed of political abolitionism, both black and white. It's the center of strength for the Liberty Party, which is an abolitionist political party. Garrison does not believe in voting. He by the 1840s says no compromise on slavery, no union with slaveholders. He thinks the Constitution is an evil bargain. It is a bargain with slaveholders and compromises on slavery. This notion that it is a, you know, an agreement with hell, a covenant with death, that's a biblical term. And Garrison uses that to condemn the U.S. Constitution, the compromises over slavery. Interestingly enough, I found in my research that he got this actually from a black abolitionist, W.C. Pennington, who had married Douglas when he fled slavery. But to go back to this issue of the Constitution, by the time Douglas moves to upstate New York and begins his own newspaper, the North Star, the North Star is the Garrisonians are wondering why is he starting a newspaper when Garrison already has one. So there's a little bit of conflict over that issue. Can the abolition movement sustain a separate newspaper? And by the 1850s, Douglas gets a huge infusion of funds from a Liberty Party politician, Gerrit Smith, in upstate New York. And he is able to maintain the North Star. But in the 1850s, the situation is also changing. And Douglas sees that. You know, he sees the controversies over slavery. It's not just the Liberty Party, it's the Free Soil Party, and eventually the Republican Party by the mid-1850s. And Douglas clearly sees a path for abolition in the political arena that Garrison does not. He outgrows his mentor. And the split between them is pretty bitter because Garrison has been his mentor for a long time. So it's personal too. But it's really over this political issue. Is the Constitution pro-slavery or anti-slavery? And why Garrison and Wendell Phillips look at the U.S. Constitution and look at the particular clauses on slavery and can literally look at those words and say, look, these are compromises over slavery. And this is why the Constitution is pro-slavery. Douglas does something that is fascinating. He looks more at the spirit of the Constitution. You know, he's what we would call today a liberal constructionist. You know, he has a progressive view of the Constitution. He sees it as a living document. He does not see that because slaveholders are the ones who are doing the sort of literal reading of the Constitution, saying it protects slavery, therefore you can't touch it. And Douglas says something fascinating. He says, no, the Constitution is actually anti-slavery in spirit. And he starts reading all these political abolitionists like William Goodell and Lysander Spooner, who've been arguing that the Bill of Rights should basically apply to enslaved people. Mm-hmm. But they are, in fact, citizens of the United States wrongfully deprived of their liberty. And I think that's a politically wise move on the part of Douglas. And in the end, he's proven right. Because that's exactly how slavery comes to an end. It comes to an end because it is abolished by the federal government. But in a way, Garrison was right too. You need three constitutional amendments to literally remake the founders' constitution, to go from a slave-holding republic to an interracial democracy. So when I looked at this dispute between them, I could see in the way in which abolition progress, how both really had that their understanding, in a way, was correct if you looked at it from one perspective. And if you looked at it from another, you could see how Douglass's point of view was in fact more effective when it came to the 1860s. And by the time they died, this is after the Civil War, after emancipation. Mm-hmm. And when I read Douglass's eulogy on Garrison when he dies, you can see that they actually have come far closer. So it's a long trajectory. Douglass goes from being a Garrisonian to that bitter split in the 1850s. But by the time you get to the 1860s, 70s, even after that split on continuing the American Anti-Slavery Society or not, by the end, they are actually inhabiting similar ground.
When our exhibit was in a small space, and we decided to focus on after the Civil War for Douglass's writings instead of before. And part of the notion there was people don't tend to look at it as much. And you can definitely see in his speeches and in what he's dealing with, especially after the amendments have been passed, is, kind of this fear that it just wasn't enough. The amendments did not do what he had hoped they were going to do. And he starts to see Reconstruction fail. And he lives through all of that. So I can definitely see where they're going to come back together on these issues. And I had a weird thought, and I don't know, I'm not a historian, you are, so I'm going to ask you, was there ever any consideration of the notion when the Civil War ends and then they have to address this issue of a new constitutional convention? Like, did anyone think that, you almost have to start over? Like, you're remaking the country. Because to some extent, Garrison's right. The document is just dripping with horrible inbuilt racism. And when we look at the issues that we currently have in our country, it never goes away. Would it have been better to say we just ripped this country in two and now we're going to put it back together? We should start over.
Oh, that's a million-dollar question, right? The thing is that 19th century Americans, even the abolitionists, actually to a certain extent, except perhaps for a few iconoclastic Garrisonians, tended to look at the Constitution and Bible in very reverential terms. Mm-hmm. There was never an idea, even amongst the most radical Republicans, that you would completely scrap the U.S. Constitution, because Americans had come to revere the Constitution, especially the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, right, as such a defining part of American democracy. I am actually writing a book right now on the Civil War and Reconstruction, and I haven't come across any suggestion for a new constitutional convention, which is interesting, right? They still wanted to retain that document, but they wanted to remake it. So that, when Bingham, John Bingham, who actually was one of the main authors of the 14th Amendment, he says, I'm going to nationalize the Bill of Rights. I'm going to come up with a notion of national citizenship. Wow. The Bill of Rights that applies against, any kind of oppression from the federal government. Now we're going to nationalize it. State governments, the local level, you can't infringe on people's rights. And I think the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments do go a long way in changing the United States from a slaveholder's republic to an interracial democracy. And that's why many people call it, the Second American Revolution, the Second Founding, etc. So you don't completely scrap the Constitution, but you do come up with these, especially the 14th Amendment, which is one of the most adjudicated amendments, comes up with this notion of equality before the law for all persons, even though it introduces the word male in the U.S. Constitution. And it comes up with this notion of national birthright citizenship, which is still contested. Yeah. The problem, I think, has been not that the original Constitution was so bad, is that many of these amendments are simply not enforced. They were nullified in the South.
Right.
And rightfully, the South should have lost representation in Congress, according to the 14th Amendment, for disfranchising African-American men. But they did not. They got away with flouting that. And the fact that people still today oppose the 14th Amendment, I think Trump wanted to do away with national birthright citizenship with an executive order. This is still contested. Mm-hmm. Or the fact that many of our modern expansion of civil rights, whether it's gay marriage, the right to privacy, or equality on the basis of sex, you know, all that comes out of the 14th Amendment's due process clause. I think, you know, they did, in fact, rewrite the Constitution substantially with those three amendments. And not until the Progressive Era would you get so many constitutional amendments coming together.
Yeah.
It's, of course, really tough to amend the Constitution. But I think Americans are very fond of the U.S. Constitution. I think it'll be hard to get rid of. It would be like throwing the baby out of the bathwater. I think there is room for us to stick with Douglass's notion of the living Constitution and let each generation make it anew.
It'll be interesting because we haven't had an amendment in a long time, and political division makes it very difficult at a state level to meet the criteria for an amendment. The ERA, you know.
Absolutely. The ERA is a good example of how that failed. But also, if you think about popular election, I mean, they made senators' elections.
Yeah.
Some states could still, you know, do sort of indirect elections through legislatures. In the Progressive Era, it's about time we had a popular election for the presidency. I still have to explain to people how is it that the person with the most number of votes did not win the presidency many times in U.S. history. So,
It is bizarre. You brought it up quickly, and it's a big part of the book. Can you talk a little bit about, as we talk about these amendments too, because that was obviously a split point, the suffragette movement that was such a huge part of the abolition movement and was so intertwined with it. Then when we come to the amendments, there's this division, you know, and Douglass was a huge abolitionist or a huge suffragette supporter, but still there was that decision that we can't get the amendment for everyone, so it will be for men still. Kind of, you know, what happened at that point?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting moment immediately after the Civil War. I mean, Douglass, as you know, was a suffragist. He published the proceedings of the Seneca Falls Convention. In fact, if he hadn't published it, we may not have it today. His newspaper's motto was, you know, right is of no color, truth is of no sex. So that represented what I would call intersectional abolitionist feminism, fighting simultaneously for Black and women's rights. And a lot of abolitionist feminists did that throughout the 1850s. So split comes not so much between abolitionists and suffragists as it is amongst the women's rights activists themselves. There are some abolitionist feminists following Lucy Stone, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, Frederick Douglass, who refused to oppose the 14th and 15th Amendment. They feel that that's the step in the right direction and that we should indeed fight for women's right, a 16th Amendment for women's right to vote. And there was a point when they had formed an organization, the Equal Rights Association, to fight simultaneously for Black and women's rights. But Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony decide at that point to oppose those Reconstruction Amendments. And in order to do that, they enter into an expedient alliance with racist Democrats who are seeking to overthrow Reconstruction. And I think that's a bit of a tragedy for the women's movement because they compromise with racism at that point. It is expedient. And the suffragist movement divide. We get two different suffrage organizations. They don't come back together until 1890. So some people think that, oh, the women's movement becomes independent of abolition at this time. But it loses a lot, too. It loses that abolitionist commitment to racial equality. And Democrats, we know, were no suffragists, as they were no abolitionists.
Right.
They used it. They used women's rights as a way to actually undermine federal laws and amendments giving Black men certain citizenship rights. And Anthony and Stanton decide to play that game for a long time until the early 1870s when they finally realize it's not working. But I think that it's a tragic legacy for the women's movement in this country to compromise with racism, because later on in the 1890s and the early 20th century, as we move towards the 19th Amendment, suffragists are more keen on wooing Southern white women into their movement and allowing segregated locals rather than fighting for Black rights. Because by that time, Reconstruction is overthrown and Black people have lost Black men have lost, certainly, all political rights, and Black people as a whole, all civil rights. So that's a tragic story, I think, of the women's movement in this country, that we lost that intersectional commitment to both Black and women's rights that the abolition movement and that abolitionist feminists represented.
Yeah.
And that's something that I would like to really end with, this notion that, that the American Democratic Project is a contested one. That, you know, to either say that it is all this or that really does not capture the nuances or the complexity or the role in which African Americans themselves have played in pushing at the boundaries of American freedom and democracy. So, you know, as a 19th century historian, I can see that constant contestation. You can see it today.
Right.
You know, the battles you think that are long fought and won actually have not been won. They're constantly in play, it seems to me. And that is the dual legacy, the Janus face legacy of American democracy, because, in fact, slavery was not an exceptional institution that was eventually done away with. You know, that Whiggish notion that we have of American freedom and democracy as progressing in this like linear line towards greater and greater freedom is simply not true if you study American history. You can see all these steps back and forth and, you know, all the contestations and the conflicts at each age. So I think once one understands that history is not simple, that you always had this conflict, that, you know, you get a better sense. So I am not one of those who believe that, you know, the, you know, simple narratives of American exceptionalism. On the other hand, I, you know, especially somebody who was born and brought up in a country not here, you know, coming as an outsider to the United States, I think the notion that this is all, you know, it's tainted, that it's inherently bad, which just, I don't think that is too simple too for me. I think this notion, I like the notion that we have to keep fighting, as Douglas, the agitator, and the abolitionist felt, that they had to keep fighting for that, for those progressive values.
I think that is a perfect place for us to wind up our conversation. It's been very enjoyable. I have a number of people posting in the question area how much they've enjoyed this. So thank you.
Thank you,
Dr. Sinha, for spending time with us and for talking about this again. And I look forward to your next book.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, hear from Andrew Blonner, Ivan Brunetti, and Chris Ware, who all contributed pieces to the Peanuts Papers, an anthology in which writers and cartoonists reflect on the legacy of Charles M. Schulz and his iconic comic strip. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.